DirecTV Stream has the most local MLB games, which means it's never been easier to.
Root, root, root for the home team.
So whether you're rooting for a... or a...
safe!
Or even a...
strike three!
Or a...
it's out of here!
Root for your home team with DirecTV Stream. The most MLB games, period. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Ask your doctor about Air Supra, albuterol budesonide. Eligible patients can pay as little as $0 per inhaler, subject to eligibility rules and maximum savings limits. Restrictions may apply. Visit airsuprasavings.com to learn more.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Stuart Broad, and this is the Analyst Inside Cricket Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket. And that little bit of World Cup commentary is appropriate, actually, because we have Joss Butler on this show a little bit later. He was a guest in our virtual cricket club the other night, and we talked quite a bit about the World Cup and the World Cup final. So it is sort of quite appropriate to have that little bit of commentary at the start. But we have to talk first about this extraordinary test match in Adelaide, Simon. 36 all out, India. Yuvraj Singh got 36 off one over against England in 2007 in the World T20. And now the team have only managed 36 all out, the lowest ever score by an Indian Test team on what looked, on the surface anyway, a decent pitch in Adelaide, actually. I mean, what was your take on it?
Well, there were all sorts of crucial moments in the game, weren't they? The Virat Kohli run out on the first day, India dropping catches and not getting as big a lead as they probably should have done. Tim Payne playing really well for Australia, almost bucking the trend and becoming man of the match. And then just that relentless Australian bowling. And I think the key on the third day, the final day, was there was just enough movement. And they're so accurate, aren't they? That's the problem. They really test your technique. And it was noticeable that if you think about the wickets that went down, there were so many little edges through to the keeper. Fine nicks through to Tim Payne, lots of catches for Payne, just enough movement for the Australians, and they were able to exploit it with that ruthless pace bowling attack that they've got. It does feel, it's a year away, but it does feel, watch out England.
Yeah, well, we'll certainly think about the implications for England touring Australia, obviously, in a year's time. Actually, what it reminded me of a little bit was that extraordinary day at Trent Bridge when Stuart Broad bowled Australia out for 60. It was one of those days where, I mean, I remember this day incredibly well, actually, because Broad came up to me at the start of play. We were looking at the pitch, I don't know, sort of 45 minutes before the start. And he looked at it and said, it looks a bit of a batting day. It looks all right to bat on to me. And I said, you're joking. Surely there's enough green there to make it do something. And he said, well, yeah, but it's not that live, that grass. I reckon we should bat first. And so lo and behold, England won the toss, fielded first, 60 all out, Broad 8 for 17. And it was one of those days where the ball did move, yes, and he bowled superbly, but everything that moved took the edge, and every edge went to hand, and every edge that went to hand was caught. Even the extraordinary catch by Ben Stokes, almost catching it behind him at gully. So it was one of those extraordinary days, and I think this one was similar in a way. The ball did just, as you say, the ball did just enough. There was enough bounce for it to carry, of course. That's another key thing. And that was the same at Trent Bridge. There's enough spring in the pitch, especially with a fresh new ball, for the edges to carry to the slips at a nice height or to the keeper. And then every ball that moved was nicked, and every nick went to the slips or to the keeper. So it was sort of an unusual perfect storm, I suppose, in a way. I think you also do have to give enormous credit to the Australian bowlers, particularly Cummins and Hazelwood, who are pretty high up in the sort of ranks of all-time best bowlers, I think, because their speeds are not only high in terms of sort of 88 miles an hour, but they also sustain those speeds with, you know, high levels of fitness. They're looked after, both of them, so they don't play as much one-day cricket, all-format cricket, as some bowlers. And I suppose the other thing is they are relentlessly accurate, and using the sort of forensics of the analysis that bowlers get these days, you know, with Hawkeye pitch maps and so on, they've been able to apply the knowledge of what ball takes the most wickets. Well, the ball that takes the most wickets is the one just on a foolish bit of a good length that is just around sort of off stump and just outside off stump. Now, we've always known that, but it's quite hard, I think, to get bowlers to really appreciate it. You know, you think of Anderson and Broad, you know, for years we've shown them pitch maps or talked about it on telly or something. Look, if you just pitch that one a bit fuller, you're going to get wickets. But no, they like to just have that slight comfort zone, a slightly shorter length, so that they don't go for runs.
Broad's been bowling a bit fuller recently, though, hasn't he?
Well, that's right. I mean, yeah. The message has sunk in, hasn't it, just over the last sort of year or two. And I think you've got two bowlers now, Cummins and Hazelwood, who are basically machines. They are supremely fit and confident, and they've absolutely honed their technique down to the nth degree. Using that analysis, they know which balls take the most wickets. And look at the Ashes of 2019, you know, where both of them were relentless, looking to, you know, hit the top of the off stump. The first couple of wickets that Cummins took in this test match in Adelaide were balls just outside off stump, which nipped back a touch and hit the top of the off stump via the batsman's inside edge, perhaps. But, you know, that's what he's looking to do. And I think they've almost perfected the ability to hit that perfect length and line consistently. And, you know, the added factor, I suppose, is they were bowling at batsmen who have been, you know, basically reared on an exclusive diet of white ball cricket for 10 months. Nobody's played a test match since January. And their techniques just were a little bit exposed. They didn't bat appallingly, but they weren't the good leave, that thing that Rahul Dravid talked about on one of our podcasts a long time ago, saying, you know, he's disappointed by the modern batsmen, that they don't enjoy a good leave. Well, there weren't too many good leaves around, were there?
There weren't. I mean, the bowling was so... Well, I mean, it is about the accuracy, though. Accuracy, pace, and a little bit of movement, and that relentlessness. And, it is a perfect storm, really, for Indian batsmen, especially, as you mentioned, you know, they haven't had a huge amount of red ball cricket. But, you know, IPL cricket, no test matches for a while. And they are just so good in their own backyard, the Australians. They showed they were very good in England last summer. It's funny, actually, you know, sometimes when you're commentating, you look at a game of cricket, you know, a game of cricket could last 40 balls, couldn't it? In theory, it could last 40 balls, a test match, because you could be bowled out for naught in both innings, 10 balls per innings. And sometimes you say that as a commentator. And it was a day like that today. It was a day like Trent Bridge as well. You know, every good ball comes along, takes a wicket, bang, you're out. 36 all out in this lowest test score. And it was one of those days. But, clearly Australia have got that in them, haven't they? They really have in those conditions. And the other thing as well is look at that all-round nature of that bowling attack now, because they've got Cameron Green, they've got Nathan Lyons, they've got the spin option. They've got Cameron Green as well, who can... He looks a terrific prospect. I mean, it seems a strange thing. Thing to say about a guy who made 11 runs and didn't take a wicket in the match. But, you know, he's capable of touching 90 miles an hour. He's got height and bounce. If they keep him fit, I mean, he can help rest some of the other bowlers as well and sustain the pressure in the way that England can do, I suppose, because they can put four seam bowlers out as well. So they've got that aspect. But what England don't have, I think, but Australia clearly do have, is a top-quality spinner. So they've got so many bases covered.
I'll just give you one other thing about that 36 all-out. All right-handed batsmen. And, you know, the word disruptor, is a trendy word, isn't it? We're sort of talking about, you know, technology, really, and modern life. But that's what you need also with those two bowlers, Pat Cummins and Josh Hazelwood in particular. And I'm not saying it's going to solve all your problems, but a couple of left-handers wouldn't do any harm, because it just makes bowlers readjust. They've got to go round the wicket. They've got to change their approach. And there were no left-handers in that Indian lineup, which is strange, isn't it, actually? Because they've normally had a Shikhar Dhawan or, you know, Ravi Jadeja down the order or somebody like that. But Yuvraj Singh. You know, we mentioned him at the start, a big left-hander. Time for a recall, Yuvraj, perhaps. Maybe not. But you know, that just also puts these bowlers under a bit more pressure. They've got to adjust. And they were able to just plug away on that same line and length relentlessly. It only took them 20-odd overs, obviously, in the second innings. But you do need that bit of alternative to bowlers just to sort of change, to force them to change. Technique, you know, I think you mentioned, we were talking about this earlier, and you said Shiel Berry wrote a piece about batting techniques. What did he say?
Well, and this is a question for you, really, Yoz. Basically, I mean, it's a really good point. The Ashes is a year away. He said, you know, the sort of bowling that Australia produced today in Adelaide shows that there is no room for batsmen at the top of the order with unorthodox techniques in Australian conditions like that. And if you look at England, the top of England's order, they have Rory Burns and they have Dominic Sibley. So how do you feel their techniques will get on in those circumstances? Of course, Burns does have an Ashes 100 at Edgbaston. I mean, he did play and miss a lot. But, I mean, is it something that is, you know, is a huge concern for England? I mean, it does look as if that's the way they're going to go. You know, they're building up. And they even sent Dom Sibley to go and play in Australia on an A tour, didn't they, after he played Test cricket. So, he is clearly the man at the moment lined up to go and open the batting in Australia next winter, and Rory Burns as well.
Well, I'll just give you two names, Marnus Labuschagne and Steve Smith. They definitely haven't got orthodox techniques, and they've got hundreds of runs, thousands of runs in Australian conditions. So I don't think that's the solution. I think what you have to know your technique. I think that's the main thing. And you have to know which balls to leave. I think leaving the ball is so important in Australia in particular, because there is that bit of extra bounce. The edges will carry. So you can't afford to, you know, hang your bat out and then get a lucky edge which drops short of the slips or goes wide of the slips or whatever. They're always going to carry, especially on that Adelaide pitch, which had a bit of sort of springy bounce. It looked a bit like, actually, they were bowling with a tennis ball. Because it had that slow, spongy sort of bounce. But at that sort of speed, you know, 90 miles an hour, 88 miles an hour, it's pretty hard to combat. So I'm not sure that it is all about side-on technique or anything, because clearly Smith and Labuschagne have been highly successful. I think it is about knowing your technique.
Don't have to face their own bowling,
well,
though,
true, but I mean, Archer would have been a handful on that pitch as well. And Smith didn't make any runs, did he, in this test match? So certainly in the first innings anyway. And Labuschagne struggled. He was dropped about four times. So, you know, there isn't a straightforward answer to how to bat. Look, Donald Bradman didn't have orthodox technique. You know, he had a sort of whirly back lift, sort of with a big circle, and played mostly off the back foot. I mean, I know it was a different era and different pitches and all that, but still, you know, it's. I don't think it's all about side on. I think that's a passe sort of argument. But I think you have got to know which balls to leave. And I think you've got to stick to a basic plan. You can't afford to not move your feet. That's, you know, the early wickets that India lost, Prithvi Shaw, Mayank Agarwal, you know, stuck on the crease, ball kind of getting through between bat and pad. You can't afford to get out like that. And I think, you know, provided these guys, the Sibleys and Burns, have a good defence, and they obviously defend the ball on their stumps well, and also ride the bounce by leaving as many balls as possible, that's a good solution. And obviously the other thing is they just need immense concentration, and because the bowlers are relentless, so the batsmen have got to be the same.
It's interesting, isn't it, watching Pujara? I mean, Pujara, you know, in a way is a sort of a template for, I mean, he's not the same sort of player, but he's the sort of template for someone like Dom Sibley, someone who's prepared to bat a really long time and chew up balls. And he did that in the first innings. I know you thought he was a bit too passive.
He was passive against Nathan Lyon in particular. You know,
well, this is what I'm going to say. Yeah. The other interesting thing about Pujara, of course, is he looks, for a player who's grown up on Indian pitches, he actually really struggles. He seems to really struggle against spin, does he? Certainly struggles against Lyon.
Yeah, I mean, Joss Butler was saying, wasn't he, in our virtual club the other night, that Lyon is quite unusual because he gets a lot of overspin and therefore bounce and bowls very well in Australian conditions. It's all about bounce. So just as England had been practising in their marquee at Loughborough recently to prepare for the Indian tour. Maybe when it comes to October, no, September, October next year, they can practice on slightly bouncier pitches in that marquee and just understand what are the shots. Now, if you watch, for instance, Kohli and Pujara playing the same balls from Nathan Lyon, Pujara is lunging at them and trying to get down the wicket and sort of kicking them away with his pad. Kohli's playing them off the back foot and looking completely comfortable. Kohli made 73 on that pitch, and he looked, apart from his sort of first 20 runs were a bit scratchy, but after that he looked as good as ever. So, you know, the good players will make runs on these pitches, but you've got to get through that first 5 to 10 overs.
Poor old Ajinkya Rahane, I mean, he's got a captain the side now. And I mean, you know, he runs out his captain. It's amazing, isn't it, how batsman's self-preservation sort of kicks in, instincts kick in at that moment. He played at the mid-off, realised he couldn't get there, and was, you know, he sells his captain, he's, you know, the best player, best player in the world, arguably, down the river, really, and yet he preserves his own wicket. And then a few minutes later, he's LBW and reviews one. I thought rather wistfully that the reason he reviewed it is he just wanted to delay by another minute the time he had to go back to the pavilion and have a chat with his captain about the run out. But I mean, it was a horrible situation for him, and now he's got to lead the side. Kohli's going home, of course, with the birth of his first child, so that's his lot. He's done now, Virat Kohli, and it's on to Ajinkya Rahane to somehow turn things round. Hard to see, I'd say. I mean, they were in a winning position. Well, they got themselves into a decent position. Whether they were ever in a winning position, they clearly weren't. But I mean, they got themselves into a decent position. First test. It always feels like the first test in Australia is so important. Not to lose it. Obviously, try to win it, and you lose, and it's so difficult.
And now they've got the MCG on Boxing Day, which has almost become the new Gabatoir. You know, it's where most teams struggle. Although, of course, England actually got a draw there the last time.
The pitch was so flat. Yeah, and
England,
pitch.
You realise it's 10 years exactly to the day that England won the toss at the MCG, put Australia in and bowled them out for 98. And they were all out. And they were 100. England were 150 for none by the end of day one. So, I mean, the momentum in Test cricket is a funny thing, actually. I'm not sure it's... I think it's a myth. I think you have to start a test match well rather than a test series, more so now. And different personnel coming in and out, whether Warner will come back in for the Australians. I suppose he will. What do you think?
Well, it's a debate, isn't it? The debate they've got about their top order. They push Wade up as a sort of a stopgap. Not that he's, he has opened before. Of course he has. But he was pushed up as a stopgap. They've got... Joe Burns and Warner to come back. Burns, of course, yeah, today, you know, discussing whether he's actually going to play in the next match. He actually made more runs today than the whole of the Indian team. He was 51 not out, and it summed things up at the end when he played the hook shot, and he was dropped on the fine leg boundary, and the ball went over the rope for six to give Australia their victory. It rather summed things up. I mean, my point about, actually, just about momentum, I agree with you. It is about how you start, but I think you've got to start well when you go to Australia as a test side. If you lose the first test, it's so difficult. One very straightforward reason why it's so difficult is because they are a good side. They're a damn good side, especially in their own conditions. They're so strong at home, and I think that India will kick themselves a bit because they did get themselves into a good position. 115 for seven in reply to 244, and they dropped some catches. They had a chance to get a much bigger first innings lead, and then, you know, the pressure then is on far more on Australia. But I mean, today, I mean, just astonishing. I woke up at 5:20 this morning, looked to my clock and thought, 5:20, oh, they'll be playing for about an hour and a quarter at the Adelaide Oval. I turned on the radio to listen to the commentary, and I heard Jim Maxwell. I heard it's quite noisy. I thought, I think they must have picked up a couple of early wickets. That's a real boost for Australia. A couple of early wickets, the pressure on India. And I heard Jim say, it's 9 for 31. I could barely believe it. I mean,
it's
an incredible day, yeah. Really. Incredible day.
Well, I mean, I did the first 2 days of that test match for BT, so I had to get up at 4 a.m. I didn't end up doing the third day. And I'm glad I didn't do it, actually, because I'd had enough after 2 days of Aussie triumphalism with the Shane Warnes and Alan Border and Mark Waugh and all those other commentators, you know, trumping about Australia. So that would have been almost unbearable to watch them or listen to them talking about 36 all out. Final word on that demise has to come from Gautam Bimani, who's the presenter on one of Star TV's cricket programmes. Lovely guy, actually, funny guy, sort of interviewer. And he's posted on Twitter here, if I call 4920408 4041, who will I get through to? Well, of course, those are the numbers of the Indian batsman in the second innings. No one even got into double figures. So a difficult few days for the Indian team.
Well, that's Australia against India. It does seem to me as if it's going to be very tough for India to come back. They're playing against an excellent side. I mean, they've got some very good players themselves, but it's not going to be easy for them in the rest of the series. Three more test matches to come. England, of course, looking ahead to a two test match series against Sri Lanka, which starts on the 14th of January. They've already been preparing for that. They've actually been preparing for it in England. They've got a big tent up at Loughborough, and they've got three grass pitches. We had Joss Butler talking about that in our virtual cricket club live on Thursday evening. So that what they're trying to do is they're trying to replicate the pitches they might get in Sri Lanka next month. But as Joss Butler says, it's not that easy.
As much as they can, they've tried to make the pitches be relevant. Certainly is spinning. I wouldn't say it's like a dry dust bowl. It's more of a wet.
A wet dust bowl? That's even worse.
but it's like a real soft wicket that spins, really. It's obviously, it's going to be so hard to recreate that, but it's fantastic for us to be able to practice on grass wickets in December. And I think, you know, turning up to places like Sri Lanka and India, it's really about reacting to what you get. I know certain times the pitches can be very flat, especially in the first half of the games, or like you say, the they can produce wickets that sort of turn from ball one. You know, look at the series last time in Sri Lanka. You know, spin dominated and seam barely played a part. But I think in India, especially now they have a real battery of strong Indian pace bowlers as well. I think they fancy themselves on most surfaces.
Give us an idea of what the tent's like, Joss. I mean, how big is it? How many pitches are there in this tent?
There's three pitches in there. I imagine you could have a pretty good wedding in there, I reckon. You could get a good bar in there and a dance floor. So yeah, it's outside the National Performance Centre at Loughborough on the pitch there. So yeah, it's three wickets and the pump heaters in there, and they've got those lights and stuff to try and grow the grass and grow and dry the wickets, etc. And it's a for what it is, you know, to be able to get on grass is a really pretty valuable for us. I think especially for guys, you know, who haven't been to the IPL and didn't do the ODIs in South Africa, you know, to be able to get a full run up in on grass, and especially for the seam bowlers to get their overs in. And I think without having sort of the opportunity to go on a warm weather camp or something like that, so I think it's been really valuable for those guys.
And are all the pitches the same? Have you got three identical, you know, type of pitches, or are they all quite different?
They looked pretty similar to me. It's the first time I've been here and played. Obviously, they're a bit slow for the seamers. They're sort of sticking the wicket a bit, and they spun. So I think as much as they're probably not going to be perfect and like for like is what we'll find, but the opportunity to face bowlers on a grass wicket and for guys to get overs in and doing proper run-ups, I think has been really valuable.
Have you actually sort of almost had your fill of cricket in a way? Because not because you've played loads, but because you've been sort of imprisoned almost in various places. Do you almost feel like I'd just like to escape for a little bit? Because you're triple format, you're going out on the 2nd of January to play in the Sri Lanka tests. You know, I mean, there's no respite.
No, and I think one thing that cricket has become a bit more 24/7, I think, with the lockdown stuff. So just, you know, being able to escape the hotel and go for dinner or go for a walk and get out and really escape. I think especially in England, just gone, you know, staying on the ground as well. Certainly made that escape a lot harder. And that's something I've always enjoyed. I enjoyed the time away from the game as well, and like to, you know, turn up to games full of energy and fresh and excited to play. And so that's sort of been a bit harder to sort of leave the ground behind, you know, especially in England. It is different. It's different for everyone. And you just want to play and be a part of these things. It's fantastic. In the IPL, Rajasthan looked after us brilliantly, and I could have my family there with me the whole time, which made a huge difference. And I think, you know, everyone's just sort of working their way through it. I think one thing the ECB has been really good about is player welfare. And I think they're very aware of mental health and trying to look after people and try and catch things early, as opposed to sort of leaving it too late for someone to then say, I'm really burnt out and I can't hack it in this environment. I think they've been really good at that and quite forward thinking, especially with this year coming up. There's a hell of a lot of cricket, and like you say, multi-format guys, your Ben Stokes, Jofra Archers, you have to be really careful how you manage them.
Does it feel like there's quite a tough winter ahead, and, you know, difficult conditions? And how do you prepare for going from the English winter, the middle of the English winter? I know you've been at Loughborough, but that sort of physical aspect of it, going from the middle of an English winter right into the furnace of Sri Lanka, and also a difficult situation, different situation this time because of the sort of biosecure nature of it.
Yeah, and I think you've got an advantage, obviously, if you're one of the players who's been there before and you know what to expect and you know how the heat is going to affect you. That, you know, you spend the first 3 or 4 days talking to each other going, God, how hot is it? And how hot is it? Whereas obviously if you've been there and experienced that, that's advantageous. And I think it's an understanding of what it's going to be like. You know, it is going to be hot and uncomfortable. And at times when you're batting, you feel, you know, to find your concentration again, you know, when you're sort of getting tired and hot. And so understanding that's a little bit what it's like. And also just that, you know, the rhythm of the cricket is a bit different in the subcontinent sometimes. So especially when there's a lot of spin bowling, you know, going on, it's, you know, that quicker pace. You know, get used to test cricket sometimes being very slow, and every ball is a big event with over rates of sort of 12 or 13. So just having an understanding, I feel fortunate to have played test cricket in Sri Lanka before and sort of have an idea of what it might be like. And then it's your preparation as soon as you get there is vital, really, to get sort of acclimatized as quick as you can.
But your fitness levels are amazing. You've been, you and Stokes have sort of egged each other on, have you? Is that fair?
A little bit. I think it was for me a few years ago, just again sort of trying to be the best you can be, and sort of a realization. Actually, a good chat with the strength and conditioning coach of England, Phil Scott, and he was very honest with me, really, and said, you're a good athlete, but you're nowhere near what you could be if you train properly. And so I think ever since then I've tried to train better. What helps, I think, is when you get a correlation between, you know, you're training well and you start to play well, you sort of put the two together a bit and you think, you know, you really believe that your training is having a great effect on your playing. So I think the whole squad has moved on a lot. You know, we're all a lot fitter than we all used to be, a lot more athletic, and that's been serving us well.
Well, it's going to be an interesting challenge ahead for England. They won 3-0 there last time. We'll wonder what the pitches are going to be like. Are they going to spin as much, or are we going to have this long game and test England's patience in the heat? I have to say, I think Sri Lanka is the hottest place I have ever been. The sort of the combination of heat and humidity. I it's the only time I've ever played cricket. I remember going on a club tour there once. The only time I've ever played cricket when I've been batting, when I thought I wouldn't mind getting out now, because it's just, you're just so hot. It's just, I mean, these are professional players who are, you know, much, much fitter and used to it as well. But it does give you an indication. You've got the helmet on as well, and, you know, baking sun in the middle of the day. It's that test against a decent opponent, but also the physical test, the huge physical test of playing in Sri Lanka as well. I know you played in Sri Lanka, Yoz, and been smacked around. You have to get back to your mark and go and bowl it again, haven't you, after being hit into the trees?
Yeah, that's true. Having seen you bat, I can imagine actually the rest of your team were hoping you'd get out as well. The odd thing about playing in Sri Lanka, actually, that I found, I played club cricket for a whole winter from January to the end of March. So, you know, I got used to it eventually. But there's two things actually about bowling. One is that you can go down to long leg after an over and field on the boundary, and people hand you drinks, spectators hand you drinks. Or you can even, actually, what I used to do, funnily enough, was some of these games, which had decent crowds at them, even though they were Premier League club matches, they'd have pineapple vendors doing, you know, going around the ground with their sort of bucket of pineapple to sell to the spectators. And I used to buy them. So I used to have a few rupees in my pocket and buy a piece of pineapple and eat it on the boundary while I was sort of resting between overs. So that was quite nice. And actually, it was the one place where when I had a drink, I actually poured it on me rather than in me, because it seemed that was a better way of cooling down. So, yes, unbelievably hot. You have to bowl short spells. Not surprisingly, Jofra Archer has been spared the difficulties, the challenge of playing over there. Although, funnily enough, it would have been quite an interesting experience for him to try and bowl on those pitches and work out how to take wickets. I think it's a learning curve. And of course, Stuart Broad actually started his test career there, won for 96 in his first test at the SSC ground. And I remember Sri Lanka pile up a massive score. It's tough. But isn't it wonderful that you can practice now in the winter in England on a grass pitch in a big marquee with heaters and everything? Obviously, they probably don't heat it up to 30 degrees, but they probably heat it up to a decent sort of temperature. So you can sort of get acclimatised before you get there. But, yeah, I mean, it's tough. The thing is, I mean, Sri Lanka aren't that good a side, so England should be all right. And they do leave no stone unturned in their preparation now, as Joss pointed out.
Yeah, we also talked to Joss about playing the ramp shot on Thursday evening, you know, one of his signature strokes. And there was an incredible over in the IPL where Nokia, the South African fast bowler, was roaring in against him. He hit him through the covers twice for four. It was a thrilling over, actually. The duel was eventually won by Nokia because he bowled him in the last ball of the over. But he played two ramp shots. Both went for four. And one of them off the fastest ball bowled in this season's IPL. It was mid-90s. It was an incredible stroke, really. So we asked Joss Butler about playing the ramp shot and how you take on a shot like that against a bowler of that pace.
I don't know, it's obviously a culmination of years of practice and trust. And as simple as you can make the game, really, is to try and hit the ball where the fielders aren't. And he had fine leg in the circle. And with his pace, you know, someone who, you know, you look at the way he bowls, he's quite a skiddy, fast bowler, generally bowls quite full. His style of ball, I thought he was going to bowl, is well suited to the shot. So it's just sort of, you know, I wasn't aware of how fast he was bowling, really. You just sort of know it's rapid, but it suits the shot, and it made sense at the time to play the shot. So that's sort of the thought process that goes into it.
As a batsman standing there, do you think you have a pretty good idea where he's going to bowl because of the field and perhaps what's come before it? And I don't know, even a cue from the way he runs in or the way, you know, are you sort of, you know, 80% certain, 90% certain of the sort of delivery you're going to receive so you can play the shot?
Yeah, it's sort of an educated gamble, really, isn't it? You sort of, sometimes you feel like the odds are generally going to be in your favour for the way he set his field, the way he generally bowls, or, you know, this will change for different bowlers. And you sort of sometimes get a bit of a feel that you think they're going to bowl a certain delivery. So, you know, you sort of factor all that in and then sort of make a decision as to what you're going to play or what you're going to look to do. And to do the ramp shot, I sort of, before the bowler's turned round, I sort of say to myself, am I 100% in? And if the answer's ever no, then I back out and don't go for it. Whereas if it's, because without the commitment to do it, you'll never execute the shot, I don't think.
I'm fascinated when you talked about practice. How much did you practice it before you put it into practice in a game? Can you remember, you know, back to first time you used it and how much you was there a thought process of, oh gosh, this looks like a risky shot. If I get out to it, then, you know, people might say this, that, and the other. So what was the thought process in the practicing and actually then going, right, I'm going to go for it in a game?
Yeah, I think back to sort of Somerset Academy and sort of trying to be inventive and guys sort of, you know, playing reverse sweeps and sort of paddles. I remember Dilshan doing it in the T20 World Cup in England, and I never quite wanted to do it in the style he did, but it, you know, it's a great shot, it made perfect sense, and that's sort of how I then tried to develop it. And I actually, if I in Dubai, I played a few T20s for England back in sort of 2012, I think, and I actually got out twice to Umar Gul playing that shot. And I actually remember in the sort of used to do team meetings after, and I think it was Craig Kieswetter, actually, obviously his teammate at Somerset as well. They're sort of he was charged with sort of reviewing the game and options and so, and he said, I got out obviously twice, and I was sort of thinking about it, oh, maybe I should put that shot away. And he said, you know, in that review, you know, for you, Joss, that was, you know, it's a great shot of yours. It's a great option just because you've got out, you know, don't really like that, that's the way you've gone for it. And so that gave me some good confidence to sort of think, you know, even when it doesn't come off, you know, if it makes sense, you know, no one's ever told me to stop playing a forward defence, and I've got out to that loads of times. So you sort of make peace with it, and it's okay. And having trust there, and now it's, you know, become such commonplace of T20 cricket, hasn't it, that you don't really criticize people too much when they go for it. But I think I practiced it a lot as a youngster. I don't do it as much now as I would do in the nets. I sort of now practice it in a very controlled environment with someone just throwing me balls, just to sort of get the muscle memory going. And now I sort of have enough trust in myself and back myself that when I need it, I can play it in a game.
Where did you actually discover that shot from? I mean, was it watching Dilshan, or was it even before that that you found you could? Where did that shot actually come from originally?
Sort of used to try and paddle sweep the seamers, and so yeah, Dilshan would be a big example of that. But I remember for me that playing it in that certain way I do, by getting front on and my head out the way. Actually, it was a T20 game at Sussex, and is it Robin Martin Jenks or Robin Martin Jenks? Was bowling, and he brought fine leg up, and for some reason I just felt like, I know he's still going to bowl length or like into the wicket, and how can I hit it over fine leg, the guy he's just brought up? So that's in my head, as if I stay up tall and sort of get to one side, I can just sort of help it over fine leg. And it, you know, it was lucky it came off straight away that time. And then that was sort of in my head then, okay, that's a great position to be in. And I like getting in that position because I feel like I can play that shot to a Yorker, a length ball or a bouncer. So I have more get out of, you know, if someone bowled a bouncer to Dilshan and he's down on one knee, you can't hit it. Whereas I feel like if I stay up on my feet, I can adapt a little bit when the ball's coming down.
It's innovation at work, undoubtedly. You are an innovator. And I know you admire AB de Villiers, who, you know, has obviously also developed these kind of shots and excels at them. Have you had a chance to talk to him about batting? Because I know you, a couple of years ago, you were hoping to meet him at the IPL or something. To this IPL, you were all sort of bunched together. Have you been able to exchange ideas at all with him?
Yeah, actually, I've managed to sort of get to know AB a little bit, and on a level where I could message him or something like that. So that's been great. And he's been fantastic to when I've had a chance to ask him a few cricket questions, to sort of give his view on things. I actually more ask him about test match cricket, really, and you know, obviously he's such a fantastic test player as well. And I, one thing I love about AB de Villiers, I think, is if I could have a setup of someone before the ball's even bowled, I think his head is in a perfect position, his feet are in such a great position. I just love his setup, and that's sort of something I'm always sort of looking to try and imitate a bit, and that's sort of where I'd love to be able to get to. So I asked him quite a lot of questions about his setup, and then I also think, as much as talking to people, the best way you can learn is just watch people. So whenever he comes into bat, whether it's a test, an ODI or T20, I love watching. There's certain guys around the world who I'm very drawn to watching them play, and I feel like I love just watching and then trying to imitate them as you would as a kid. Yeah, and the IPL is brilliant for that, because you get to see guys so close up, whether it be in your own team at the nets, guys you wouldn't usually see, or you could even be training sometimes at the same time as say Bangalore, and you could see that Kohli and de Villiers are in the nets. I'm just going to wander around and just watch them and see what they do. And that is just for me is as good as talking to people, is just to sort of watch them go about their business.
That must be weird that if you're playing against him, you almost want him to succeed, to see how well he does. At the same time, you don't want him to destroy your bowling attack. So,
yeah, I actually remember. Well, I think he destroyed us this year, and I was running to long runs, and I saw they needed 36 off two overs. And actually, he's that good. I actually thought, God, they could win this with an over to spare.
I know that's one of your great theories about the IPL. Yoz, you have a lot of theories about the IPL, but one of them is that it's a great mixing ground, sort of changing ground of ideas for players. And you know, clearly, Jos Buttler admires AB de Villiers. Although it's interesting there, he was saying that he actually wanted to talk to him about batting in Test cricket rather than white ball cricket. Of course, Buttler's a extremely accomplished white ball cricketer, and his Test match figures don't quite stack up in the same way.
No, I mean, de Villiers, I've watched his videos about Test batting, and they're really interesting. He has a theory about playing everything in the box, and I think when I say the box, he draws a sort of an imaginary box around the crease, and he doesn't play anything. He tries not to play the ball outside that imaginary box he creates for himself, which doesn't go far forward of the front crease, unless, of course, he's coming down the wicket to a spinner or something. In other words, he's trying to play pretty much everything under his nose and playing the ball late. And I think what Jos wanted to talk to him about, as much as anything, was how do you adapt from white ball to red ball cricket, which de Villiers has done probably as effectively as most. I mean, Kohli would be another that's done it too. It's difficult, isn't it? You look at Johnny Bairstow, for instance, who's lurched into the Test match team and out of it, and then prolific in the one-day side, but lost his place in the Test side, in and out again. And it does examine your technique, red ball cricket, whereas white ball, sort of almost, it's the opposite. It doesn't matter about technique. It's about attitude, probably more, as well as, ball striking talent too. So I think it's, de Villiers has, in the prime of his career, sort of perfected how to adapt his game from white ball to red ball. And I think it's that Buttler's really interested in finding out. I mean, he's a real deep thinker on the game, Jos, isn't he? You don't, when you look at him on the outside, you think this guy who's got this rich talent and just natural lack of inhibition, and he probably just goes out there and bats. But actually, there's a huge amount of thought and sort of analysis that goes into his cricket. And I'm sure that's one of the reasons why he's so treasured as a player.
Yeah, one thing I took from the evening was, that question about him staying really calm. Vic Marks's comment about, that man's got ice in his veins. And he didn't knock it back, did he? He said, I do on the field. I actually do feel incredibly calm. And, of course, we couldn't have him in our virtual cricket club without asking him about the World Cup final, when he was involved in that partnership with Ben Stokes, a century partnership that sort of got England close, up towards their victory target. Then he got out, and it looks as though the game was slipping away from England. But he was involved in sort of the moment. He was, that run out right at the end. So when we asked him about the World Cup final, we started with that final ball of the Super Over with New Zealand needing two to win. And Buttler says he was still pretty confident then of England's chances.
I think Jofra is such a superstar and has just risen to every occasion, and this was no different. And I actually had quite a lot of belief. If he gets a Yorker in here, we're actually a great chance of effecting a run out. I remember Morgs moved one of the backward points across to mid-wicket as well.
Bairstow and Roy, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think Rooty went on the ring at mid-wicket as well. So if he just jammed it out, it would go straight to him and we'd be able to run him out. So, I think we set a good field. I remember just thinking to myself, just do your job. Don't be the bloke to mess it up. And all of us will just do our job. Jofra will do his. And fingers crossed, something amazing could happen. If I could relive anything again, it would be that 20, 30 seconds just after we took the bails off.
Funnily enough, I spoke to Owen Morgan today, and he said that the feeling then was a bit like you're a kid, say 10, and you're at the top of a hill and you're on your bike and you think, shall we go down this hill? Shall we try? This hill is the steepest hill we've ever been on. Shall we give it a go? And you sort of, you're a bit nervous, but you then let go. And it's just this most sort of exhilarating feeling. And you want it to almost get faster and faster. And you sort of forget about anything that's gone before, I suppose. Let's just watch it back, that last moment again. Talk us through it.
Well, you know that we had plenty of time because it had gone straight to him. Lords is like a billiards table, so you're going to get a good bounce. But I had to jump round the stumps and get back. But just knowing I had time, I think made me, and you're so, you know, lots of people, you know, after, like, what were you thinking? Were you thinking, what if I drop it? But, you know, as a professional sportsman and people, you know, when you're just doing your job and that's it's programmed into sort of, you know, if it's not a World Cup final, it's actually a really simple run out. So you're just engrossed in the moment and so engaged in it. But then as soon as you hit those stumps, the realization of the consequence of what's just happened is amazing.
Something Mark Wood said on one of these earlier evenings, Joss, he said the World Cup final, it was a horrible day. It was up and down all day. It was tense. It was tight. I didn't really enjoy it that much. What was your experience of the day? You know, you talked about the elation of that moment. Of course, nothing you ever do in your life will take that away from you. It's a fantastic, incredible moment. And anybody who was there that day, they will never forget it. And it will stick in their mind forever. What was the day like though?
Not too bad. I remember like a bit of rain around as well in the morning. So that driving to the ground, that was a bit like typical England, you know, our big day and it's just started to rain. I felt like New Zealand's innings, like, it was sort of, it wasn't the most exciting, not much happened, they didn't take too many risks, we bowled pretty well, and it was sort of not that exciting, really, but I felt like, you know, we've done a pretty good job there. It's not straightforward wicket, but, really confident we could score the runs, and then I think the tension started to come in with the bat. We were, you know, lucky first ball of the innings. I think, you know, it could have gone either way, that decision against Jace. And I think when I first started to panic a bit was when Ruti ran down at the Grandome and had the biggest swing I've ever seen him have on a cricket field. And he was my banker. You know, this was made for him, this situation. You know, he'll be 100 not out at the end of the day. But I think once you get in the middle, again, that's when you get some control and being able to affect the game, and that made me feel more comfortable being out there in the middle and just being part of that partnership. And I felt when I got out, I felt horrendous, and you know, when you're watching in the dressing room then and you're kicking yourself for getting out and not seeing your team home, and that was awful. And then when it was a super over, obviously it's carnage, but again, for me, that made me feel better again. It was like I can affect the game again. Like I've got another chance, which you never get in cricket. So that was actually really focused my mind, and I thought actually focused everyone really to sort of, okay, we've got a second chance, because it's certainly, you know, the way the game ebbed and flowed, we'd certainly had a few chances already. So yeah, I did manage to have some points where I really enjoyed it, though. Batting with Stokesy, I think it went, the runs needed went from sort of triple figures down to double figures. And we'd run two or three twos in an over. And the crowd started to get going and there was some belief. And I was so special, just in the middle with Ben. And we just sort of looked at each other like, how good is this? Like, this is so cool. And we were just... And that was nice to have like a bit of a moment in the game where you sort of take it all in and appreciate what's happening, and then sort of straight back to, okay, concentrate again, like got a job to do. But I that was a really clear memory of both of ours, that we actually did take it in.
Sounds like you enjoyed the day a bit more than Woody then, from what you're saying. The noise was incredible, actually. I mean, it was replicated at Headingley a few weeks later with Ben Stokes' innings, but I don't think I've ever heard Lords that noisy. Ever,
even close. Yeah, Lords is always somewhere sort of has a bit of a hum, doesn't it? And never quite gets to that level. But the sort of goodwill and the, you know, the crowd really pushing everyone on and willing the ball towards the rope or over the rope, and now to playing a World Cup final at Lords and it being that kind of game is. Yeah, it's goosebump kind of stuff. It's just remarkable game of cricket.
How many times have you watched it?
I reckon the next day about the thousand. I watched it to the Titanic music and all sorts. So, yeah, I watched it lots. And actually in the lockdown, Sky did like a rerun and everyone sort of sat and watched it and a bit of a watch along thing. And that was the first time I'd actually watched the whole game. So, yeah, and it's funny. Yeah, sometimes, you know, on TV, it's different to how you remember it in the middle. So sometimes it's actually not as good to watch it back because you sort of forget those what it looked like through your own eyes.
That last moment, I suppose, must be an absolute thrill to watch back, and you're never in any doubt that you're going to catch the ball and destroy the stumps, presumably.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's nice to watch it back knowing that it went well. Now, I remember sort of battling before the game really as well about sort of what if the next day doesn't go right, like how will I cope, you know, and move forward. And you know, we've all put so much into this, as every other team has as well, but it was sort of our time and it was meant to be. And so I was really battling the day before of, you know, what if it doesn't work out. And it's only after, you know, like after, you know, doing some interviews and stuff, people then start saying, oh, what if you dropped it, what would have, you know. And then you think, oh god, how would I live with myself? But you know, luckily it didn't happen.
So you were able as a team to kind of banish those negative thoughts most of the time, it seems, and that was part of the sort of culture almost.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think some people in the team at the moment, they've sort of come into this, their fearless team that's been doing well, and they don't know any different, you know, a lot of guys. And I think we had a really good team meeting at Edgbaston before the India game. We just lost a couple of games and, you know, we had to win every game to go through. And I was sort of sat there thinking, you know, I've got lots of inhibitions, I'm nervous, I'm worried about the consequences of, you know, what. And but some guys in the room were just like, well, it's no problem, like we just win four games and we've won the World Cup, like we're the best team in the world, we're playing at home, why not. And I was sat there like, this is amazing that people genuinely, you know, believe that, and that gave me confidence to hear that. And it's actually another favourite bit of the World Cup for me is the way Roy and Besto went out against India and just, you know, in our time of biggest pressure we'd ever been under, and they just went out and just stayed true to exactly how we want to play our cricket and just smacked it everywhere. And I was just, from that moment, I felt like, you know what, if this works out or not, I'm so proud that these two lads have just gone and stayed true to exactly what we've talked about being a team for the last 4 years.
You suffer from nerves? Surely not. Where are they? I mean, come on.
No, I think
you never look nervous.
No, not on the field, because you can do something. So it's more off the field. I just want to be able to have control. And on the field, you have control. So that makes me feel calm. But yeah, certainly have some nerves away from the ground.
Something that Vic Marks, I mean, he said to me a while back, you'll know Vic very well, of course, so your Somerset connection. He said that boy has got ice in his veins. Is that how you feel on the field? That you always feel calm because you know you can affect the game, and you know you've got the sort of memory of playing, you know, exciting innings and match winning innings and winning, you know, winning games at the end. Is that how you always feel out there?
I certainly feel, yeah, pretty calm in the middle. I think certain games I've felt more nervous than others, but generally it's when I was younger and it's sort of you're doing something for the first time. I've always enjoyed that challenge of being not out at the end is the greatest thing for me. You know, if you've seen your team home at the end and sort of finish the game, and like you say, when you are in the middle, I do find it calming that I can affect the game. I think my nature is sort of quite calm and quiet and sort of, and I think that reflects in my demeanour maybe when I'm batting as well. But at the same time, I feel like I have a good intensity that I need in international cricket. And that certainly brings it out in you, you know, when you're in those environments. And I think one guy, you know, Owen Morgan, was always someone I looked at when I first came into the England team as a guy I really liked. You know, he played all the shots. He did it a bit different. He did it his way. And talking to him very early on, you know, he's said he just likes to take emotion out of the game. He makes better decisions without the emotion, remains calm, and that really works for him. And I sort of tried to take a bit of that into my game. But I think the key to it really is really understanding yourself and knowing what the best version of you looks like in the middle. I think I watch a Virat Kohli, a very emotional cricketer, and a very, and that brings out the best in him. You know, you talk about sometimes on the field, you know, try not to get in a battle with him because it sort of gets him going, and that's what he wants. Whereas, you know, other guy, you know, Hashim Amla, he looks like he's, you know, just playing at the park with his mates and he's not really bothered, and that's his thing. So for me, it's been sort of working out what my best sort of state is in the middle and sticking to it.
Well, great memories there of the World Cup final from Jos Buttler. And we're glad to say we've had lots of really interesting guests apart from him on our virtual cricket club over the last couple of months. Joe Root, Stuart Broad, Mark Wood, retired stars like Alistair Cook and Graham Swan, Isha Guha. I thought she was really interesting, actually, talking about adapting from life as a player to a commentator. And she's very prominent in Australia at the moment, doing commentary on the Australia-India series. So we've got lots of guests coming up after Christmas in the Virtual Cricket Club. Please join us at worldsbestcricketclub.com because we're going to replay some of the best bits of our club over the next couple of weeks while we have the Christmas break. And then we'll start again with some live events in early January. So thanks very much for everyone who's joined that club. And please tell your friends. It's a really interesting place. I'm going to post lots of podcasts and blogs over the next few weeks as well until we get back into live events. Simon, who would you pick out? Who did you enjoy the most?
I actually liked them all. I thought they all said really interesting things. And by the way, you know, if you want to catch up on the Virtual Cricket Club podcast, they are available as well on this stream. Lots of tips, lots of insights into the game of cricket, and playing for England, broadcasting, whatever, what it's like after you've retired as well, in the case of someone like Tuffers and Graham Swan. So that's all there for you. It's been fantastic to have them all with us, and we hope to bring in many more excellent guests in the new year. So we're coming up to Christmas, Yoz. Is that time of the year again. Very much looking forward to the end of Christmas, aren't we? Or actually Christmas Day itself, I don't know. I always find my favourite time of the year is 12:01 on Christmas night, or, you know, early morning Boxing Day. Christmas is as far away as it can be.
You old Scrooge. Tell me this. Do you wear shorts on Christmas Day?
Well, yeah, because my wife has the central heating up really high. So, yeah, they stay on, I'm afraid. But
excellent. She's
just stormed into the room.
Get out. I'm leaving that bit in.
No, you're not. Get out. Anyway, my campaign to have Christmas every 4 years hasn't been that successful. We had to put the decorations up in about late November this year to try and sort of combat all the sort of COVID gloom. So all the lights have been up for about a month or two. But I'll be campaigning to have them taken down as soon as possible afterwards.
Well, I just hope you out there enjoy your run-up to Christmas more than Mr. S. Mann. Thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you during the week.
Merry Christmas, everybody.
Podcast Network.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right, ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.